The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
If you go back to the Art of War, it's about knowing your enemy and knowing yourself. And what the Doolittle Raid ultimately did was change Japan's strategy, change Japan's thinking about itself and about how it should win the war. It went from a posture of trying to win a war to a posture of trying not to lose a war. And that's ultimately a disastrous strategy in any conflict, in any competition. And the Doolittle Raid is largely to credit for that real strategic change in Japan's outlook towards the broader war.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, August 3rd, 2020. Michelle Paradis is a scholar of international law and human rights, who has worked for more than a decade for the U.S. Department of Defense Military Commissions Defense Organization, where he has worked on a number of the landmark court cases to arise out of Guantanamo Bay. Most recently, he is the author of the book Last Mission to Tokyo, The Extraordinary Story of the Doolittle Raiders and Their Final Fight for Justice. It's the story of two military commissions that arose out of the first U.S. bombing raid over Japan during World War II. One, the trial by the Japanese of a number of Americans who participated in the raid, and the other, after the war, of the Japanese who conducted that first trial for their conduct of that trial. Michelle joined me in the virtual jungle studio to discuss the extraordinary history he uncovered, how he came to be interested in these cases, and how they relate to the ongoing U.S. experiments with military commissions. It's the Lawfare Podcast, August 3rd, Michelle Paradis on Last Mission to Tokyo. Michelle, let's start with your day job. You are not a World War II historian by background. I assume you came to this project as a result of what you do for a living. Tell us about the relationship between the work that you've done over the last, it's getting on a lot of years now, and the book that you've just written.
It is getting on a lot of years, and this book is proof of that. So my day job is that I work in the Military Commission Defense Organization, which is the Department of Defense's legal office to represent the Guantanamo detainees who've been charged before the military commissions. And I started this job at the end of the Bush administration. And I remember when a controversy was still alive as to whether or not waterboarding constituted torture. And we had heard of a story, a rumor really, of a case in which what we had heard was the Japanese were prosecuted for waterboarding after World War II. So we sent a young Marine captain to the National Archives to get the record of trial. And when the Marine captain came back with this PDF, I started reading it and was just blown away. It actually just kicked me in the chest because all of the things that I was dealing with in the military commissions in Guantanamo in one way or another were being dealt with back in 1946 in a war crimes trial held of the Japanese in Shanghai, China. But one of the more startling revelations that I had as I was doing that was that many of the things we were actually prosecuting the Japanese for doing, using evidence tainted by torture, not the torture itself, prosecuting on the basis of an ex post facto law denying various constituent elements of a fair trial, such as the right to counsel of choice, the adequate translation of the evidence, the right to be prosecuted under a law that applies equally to Japanese and non-Japanese civilians. All of these various things that formed the basis of our prosecution of the Japanese were things that the United States was doing in Guantanamo. And that really kind of caught me up short. It kind of shocked me as a sort of fairly traditional American boy from Pennsylvania. And so the story really stuck with me. And a number of years later, I realized that it was worth telling as a longer story. And then as I researched it more, so many of the constituent elements just were so bizarre and so interesting at a human level. And the people I was writing about were just so fascinating that I ultimately decided to write it the way I did, which is much more of a piece of narrative history than it is a straightforward legal history.
All right. So the story is of the so-called Doolittle Raiders and two trials that took place. One of them, when the Japanese got their hands on them in 1942, and the second after the war of the Japanese who put them on trial. So let's start with, before we get to the court cases, let's start with the raw military history here. Who were the Doolittle Raiders? Who was John Doolittle? And how did they end up in Japanese custody?
Yeah, the Doolittle Raid is probably one of the most, if not the most, significant operations of the Pacific War. And it's been told in legend, it's been told in movies. Michael Bay's Pearl Harbor uses it as the climactic denouement of its movie, of the movie. And what happens is that the first part of 1942 is a disaster for the United States, as far as World War II is concerned. The Japanese are on the march. The Germans are on the march. The U.S. campaign in North Africa is not going well. The United States has lost its largest colony, the Philippines. The Bataan Death March is underway. And the Doolittle Raid is meant to be an opportunity where the United States says, not only are we going to fight this war, we're able to win it. And what they ultimately do is tap a plucky young Air Force lieutenant colonel who had been a stunt pilot for much of the decade before, but also happened to hold an MIT doctorate in aeronautical engineering. And he devised a plan to take off medium-range army bombers from an aircraft carrier to do a one-way mission over Japan. And, it's difficult to understand the dangerousness of what they were doing and the improbability of it all. But nevertheless, in April 1942, they conduct this raid. They attack Japan for the first time in its history, in its recorded history. Japan is attacked from abroad. And what had been largely understood to be a probable suicide mission, where the crews of these 16 planes were likely to be shot down, were likely to be tortured, were likely to be executed by the Japanese, and even if they made it out of Japan, were likely to crash into the ocean on the way to China. Instead, what happens, all but 10 members of Doolittle's Raiders, of the 80 men, all but 10 of them end up escaping safely into China and returning home as probably the most celebrated heroes of World War II. And that's the starting point of my book, because, one of the lesser told stories is of the 8 American airmen who are part of the Doolittle Raid who actually get captured by the Japanese in China.
All right. So before we get into that, I just want to focus a little bit more on the raid. My impression of this raid, which is, famously, as you described, the first American bombing run over Japan, is that it had essentially no strategic significance at all. The sole point was to make the kind of almost spiritual statement that we can hit the Japanese homeland, which is significant because, number one, the Japanese could not hit the U.S. homeland in any significant way. And secondly, because it was imagined as a way to foreshadow what was going to come as islands started to get taken back. As you point out, the Japanese had a almost mystical sense, or maybe it wasn't almost mystical, it was mystical, that the spirits, or the kami, protected the Japanese islands and would not allow them to be attacked. So how would you describe, other than that it was daring, and what was the strategic goal of the Doolittle raids, and to what extent were they, I guess it becomes a kind of mythologized in song and story, but what was the purpose of them at the time?
So the purpose was exactly what you said. It was, you know, to put a fine point on it, to punch Japan in the nose when it thought it was invulnerable. And so, yes, on a tactical level, the mission was largely insignificant. You know, a few bombs were dropped on a few factories in a few areas of Japan. And, you know, the Japanese continued to fight the war and to still have a lot of strategic advantages for a number of years. But the strategic value of the raid really can't be understated. And I'll point to a couple different things that, you know, really show that sometimes bombing for show is all you need to change the behavior of your enemy. So the psychological effect, I don't think it is an exaggeration to say that the Doolittle raid was Japan's 9/11. This is a people who really did believe, for spiritual and also just practical reasons, that they were immune from attack from abroad. And so the very idea that anything could reach Japan, that the United States could presage an attack that could, you know, kill civilians, that could damage war material, fundamentally changed the Japanese view of their place in the world and their prospects of winning in the war. And so what did that cause Japan to do? Well, for one thing, it caused them to hasten the launch of what became the Battle of Midway, which was a total strategic disaster, in part because it was hastily planned. Why was the Battle of Midway hastened? Well, because there became an irrational premium on taking out America's carrier fleet as a way of preventing further carrier-based air raids against Japan. And in the process, Japan ends up losing, I think, three of its own aircraft carriers in that sort of failed battle. In China, Japan immediately goes from a pacification strategy that had been largely successful, if only in dividing the various factions who were fighting for and against the United States and Japan all in throughout China. It changes Japanese strategy from what we would probably call a counterinsurgency strategy today to a campaign to destroy every airfield in China. This is a mission that ultimately costs tens of thousands of Chinese lives, wastes enormous numbers of resources for very little tactical benefit inside China, and has the effect of hardening Chinese resolve against the Japanese at a time when, again, Japan had been certainly seen as one of many different options for various factions operating inside of China in the early 1940s. And then the longer-term strategic disaster that it provokes Japan to undertake, or the long-term strategic sort of disastrous decision that Japan takes in response to this bombing, is they start putting an irrational premium on their own air defenses. And so one of the ways that Japan had actually succeeded in defending itself, defending its territory, was by pushing its defensive perimeter further and further out. Remember, in 1942, Japan is bombing Australia. So Japan really, it was outside the reach of any serious capacity that the Allies had to conduct any kind of bombing raids or any kind of attacks. In response to the Doolittle raid, this fear of another attack, this fear of other sort of carrier-based attacks or stunt attacks, compels the Japanese army to withhold its air forces back to Japan and to decline to provide air forces to its commanders who are forward deployed in the field. And they essentially relinquish air superiority as a result, which makes the island hopping you talked about ultimately possible, because Japan is essentially trying to now defend islands primarily through naval and land-based engagements, and the United States is essentially able to overwhelm them. So they give away one of their greatest strengths in the beginning of the war, which was their overwhelming air superiority over such a large distance of the territory of Asia. The strategic value then of the Doolittle raid, you know, certainly there are many debates to be had as to what is the most strategically significant battles of World War II. But I certainly would put the Doolittle raid right amongst the top of the pantheon, because, you know, if you go back to Clausewitz, it's, you know, war is politics by other means. If you go back to the Art of War, it's about knowing your enemy and knowing yourself. And what the Doolittle raid ultimately did was change Japan's strategy, change Japan's thinking about itself and about how it should win the war. It went from a posture of trying to win a war to a posture of trying not to lose a war. And that's ultimately a disastrous strategy in any conflict, in any competition. And the Doolittle raid is largely to credit for that real strategic change in Japan's outlook towards the broader war.
All right. So with that as background, 80 people go on these raids. How many of them survive them, and how many of them are captured by the Japanese?
So all but three survive. All the planes, except for one that ends up landing in the Soviet Union, end up crash landing, or they end up parachuting out of their planes and allowing their plane to crash inside of China. Of those, three are killed in the various plane crashes. Two die in a crash off the East China Sea, and one young man dies when he hits the rocks as he's falling from the sky. So, but the rest survive, but eight ultimately are captured by the Japanese inside of China.
And what happened to the others? So we're narrowing the dramatis personae down here. We start with 80, three are dead, 10 get captured, and the remaining 67, what happened to them?
Sure. So the remaining 70. So of those 10, three are killed. So of the remaining 70, they all have these just fascinating, riveting, harrowing stories of managing to get through the Chinese countryside to a city that is still there called Kuzhou. And they basically rally over the next couple of weeks. They rally inside of a cave in Kuzhou, ultimately, which is part of the area that is at least more contested. It's largely under Chiang Kai-shek's control, but it's a contested territory. And Chiang Kai-shek ultimately helps them all get to safety. And so all but this group of 10 not only survive the Doolittle raid and the subsequent crashes in China, they actually are able to escape from China to the United States. And they're all the individual stories are great. So if you want a sort of a great early read, there's a book called 30 Seconds Over Tokyo, which is by the pilot, of one of the planes that ends up crashing off the East China Sea. And it's just this great World War II story. It was made into a blockbuster movie within a year of the Doolittle raid actually happening. And, you know, it's one of the defining stories of World War II and the Doolittle raid specifically.
And yet, eight are captured. So who are these guys? How'd they get captured? And what happens to them?
Yeah, so one group of five end up parachuting outside of Nanchang, which is in Japanese-controlled China. In very short order, within a night, they're all rounded up and taken in by the Kempei Tai, which is the Japanese secret police, clandestine service, military police. They have a number of different hats they ultimately wear. Another three who crash off the East China Sea, about 100, 200 miles south of Shanghai, get captured by Japan-allied Chinese guerrillas. And then turned over to the Japanese Kempei Tai in Shanghai. And in all cases, the Doolittle raiders find themselves at the hand of the Kempei Tai and are brutally tortured. They're waterboarded, they're subjected to stress positions, they're subjected to all sorts of, being hung from their hands, sleep deprivation, prolonged solitary confinement, you name it. And quickly then they're taken, the eight who are captured are taken to secret locations inside of Tokyo. By the Kempei Tai, and a debate breaks out inside the Japanese parliament as to what is to be done with the Doolittle raiders. Certainly one of the revelations for me in doing this book was what a complicated society Japan of the 1940s actually was. I think there's a tendency to always think of the Japanese as essentially the Nazis of the East. And that to say that that is wrong is not to excuse anything Japan did, certainly. But it's certainly to help us understand how countries can do horrible things, even when they have very good intentions or when there are plenty of people in the government who have very good intentions. Because by the early 1940s, Japan's government had become essentially riven with a deep political divide between, essentially a fascist movement, a hardcore militaristic revanchist movement that was trying to make Japan great again. And, very urban, liberal, internationalist Japanese who had succeeded really over the past 100 years in making Japan one of the leading lights when it came to international cooperation, the rule of law, liberalism. Japan was one of the first countries to sign the Geneva Conventions of 1929. But by the time World War II starts, its politics had taken this very harsh turn. And yet, inside the Japanese cabinet, these two factions essentially attempted to coexist. And by attempting to coexist, they largely attempted to just kill each other. And someone like Hideki Tojo, who was not a charismatic leader the way Benito Mussolini or Adolf Hitler was more, I always kind of use the analogy of someone like John Boehner He's this boring, fairly clerk-like compromise between all of these rival factions who is believed to essentially be able to keep the most extreme elements at bay and fails to do so. So when the Doolittle Raiders are captured, these basic divisions inside of Japan's cabinet just become seething hot. And you have on the one side, the hardcore militarists saying, we should just behead the Doolittle Raiders. Let's execute them as publicly as possible to deter Americans from doing something like this again. But on the other side, you have the liberals. You have people like Foreign Minister Togo, who say, no, we agreed to comply with the Geneva Conventions. If we commit abuses against the Doolittle Raiders, those abuses are going to be taken as an excuse to commit atrocities against the Japanese. There are, at this point, tens of thousands of Japanese held in concentration camps inside the United States. And so the cabinet basically freezes up over this debate about what to do with the Doolittle Raiders. And ultimately, the way this is resolved is a compromise is reached. They go to the lawyers in the war ministry and say, we need to find a way of legally executing the Doolittle Raiders. And the lawyers in the war ministry come back and say, well, you can't. That's illegal. The Geneva Conventions prohibit it. The laws of war prohibit it. And the message is sent back to the war ministry. You don't understand. If we don't find a legal way of killing them, the Kempei Tai is just going to kill them secretly and claim it was an accident. And we can't have that because no one is going to believe that. So the lawyers in the war ministry ultimately start, trying to figure out trying to square the circle. And their ultimate solution is to try the Doolittle Raiders before military commissions as war criminals. There's no law allowing this in Japan at the time. There are a lot of complicated reasons for that, some of which I go into in the book. But they decide, well, we'll just pass an ex post facto law that incorporates international law by reference, and we'll prosecute the Doolittle Raiders under this law for committing atrocities against the Japanese, and that will give us a pretext for executing them. And so that's what they do. The biggest problem, though, is they need to have evidence of atrocities. And so where do they go to prove the atrocities? Well, a principal place, as the Soviets used to say, the queen of all evidence, they get confessions. The Kempei Tai, through their practiced methods of torture, ultimately get all eight of the Doolittle Raiders to sign confessions to committing atrocities against the Japanese. And so in August of 1942, the Japanese conduct this military commission in Shanghai, China, sentence all eight of the Doolittle Raiders to death. And then ultimately the emperor commutes the sentence of five of them so that only three of the Doolittle Raiders are executed. And this becomes one of the great publicized outrages of the Second World War.
All right. So there's so much here. Before we go on, I want to unpack a bit of this. So first of all, at the same time that this is going on, you mentioned the Bataan Death Marches, the Japanese conquest of a bunch of the islands that you refer to is particularly war crime heavy. The Japanese approach to, they took relatively few prisoners in a lot of circumstances. Their conduct in this part of the war in the Philippines, in the Malaysian Peninsula was really stunningly bad. And to the point that they developed quite a reputation among the Allied forces as kind of, as sort of quite different even from the Germans on a sort of the average behavior of the average soldier. And so I guess I'm fascinated by the idea that there would be a real debate about how to handle these particular captured soldiers or airmen. It's not like there weren't literally tens of thousands of British and Australian and American, not to mention, Singaporean and Malaysian and, Filipino people in Japanese custody. And there doesn't seem to have been a whole lot of debate about legalities about how to handle them. An enormous number of people were just bayoneted to death. So my question is, why did this one get fixated on, of all things, legality in the context of wartime Japan?
So I think there are two main reasons for that. One is the profile of the Dula Raid itself. You know, as I mentioned, you know, briefly, the Dula Raid really was Japan's 9/11. It's something that the people of Japan itself understood very well. And so the fact that some of the Dula Raiders had been captured put a profile on them that, you know, what was happening in remote outposts and colonies just wouldn't have had inside of Japan. And so that's one answer, is that it was just much more, they were just much more important. They were very high value detainees. The second answer, though, is that and this maybe gets to sort of, again, one of the things that I found most fascinating in researching, you know, Japan's sort of sense of itself in the Second World War, is that the Japanese were certainly guilty of all sorts of just, you know, stunning atrocities throughout the war and throughout the part, particularly throughout the part of the war you were mentioning. But it was far more a function of undiscipline than it was systematic cruelty and barbarity. But the Japanese did have a sense of themselves as basically noble, righteous, liberal people. The idea that prisoners would be abused or tortured, and you can see this inside of Japan's own news reporting, their own propaganda, in interviews with the Japanese after they've been captured, that there was no one believed that these atrocities were actually being committed by Japanese soldiers. And to the extent these kinds of things were being done, it was all the work of bad apples. And if you again look at Japan's propaganda, there is far more of a tendency to ascribe atrocities to the Allies, to say that the Allies are conducting this barbarous, racist war of colonialism inside of Asia. Again, is this at all to excuse Japan, what the Japanese did in these places? Absolutely not. But it's to understand that well-meaning countries, countries that have not fully swallowed the poison of fascism, can end up doing horrible things, largely through a belief that they're incapable of doing horrible things, or that not, you know, good Japanese boys wouldn't be doing things like that. And so take the Bataan Death March. One of the more fascinating things about the Bataan Death March, as you, if you dig into it, is that there were basically various caravans that were each controlled by a different Japanese lieutenant all along the way of the march. Some American soldiers got plenty of rest, plenty of food, plenty of water, said it wasn't that, you know, big of a deal. It was humiliating to be captured, but it certainly, you know, wasn't dangerous to their lives. Yet, you know, another caravan of American soldiers just a mile back, subject to the whims of another Japanese lieutenant, would be beaten, bayoneted, starved, and, you know, would have very, very high levels of fatality and casualty. And I think that actually makes Japan's war crimes far more interesting, because they're being done not as part of a systematic holocaust, the way Nazi war crimes were done and crimes against humanity were done. They're being done through not even a wink and a nod. It's more of just a turning of a blind eye, a belief that there's no way we could be doing shameful things. And that ultimately leads to just as catastrophic of consequences as a country that actively sets out to do horrible things the way, you know, the Germans did.
Yeah, so I guess I would, I don't resist that point as a general characterization, but I wouldn't want to overstate it either, because the Japanese occupation of Korea starting in 1910, you know, has a lot in common with, say, the German occupation of Poland, right? It's a very deliberate attempt to kind of create Lebensraum and to subjugate the subject peoples with a really clear doctrine of racial inferiority driving it. Your point probably as a general matter is well taken, but I do think there are significant exceptions to that where the Japanese conduct looks much more organized and deliberate. Certainly certain parts of the Chinese occupation as well, no?
Absolutely. And so again, don't mistake me. I'm not here being an apologist for the Japanese, but I think it's important that we understand how these things happen, right? Whereas something like the Holocaust or even the Eastern Campaign is done, you know, really as almost a top-down strategy. In Japan, it was not ground up. I think that's a mischaracterization as well. But it was as much a perverse byproduct of extreme forms of bureaucracy and discretion and this just genteel attitude. Well, everyone knows what their responsibilities are, and therefore we don't actually have to provide meaningful oversight and accountability for, you know, people who do horrible things. And I think those are two different regimes of atrocity. And I think it's just a mistake to understand the Japanese as operating with the same kind of regimented fascist ideology. They certainly had people in the government who were very much proponents of that. But just to, you know, as an example, when Mussolini dies, Italy's out of the war. When Hitler dies, it's only a matter of days, but Germany is out of the war. Tojo ceases to be the prime minister of Japan in the summer of 1944. The war rages on for another year. And it's because Japan is just not as centralized as most. It's not as centralized in its command and control of authority as the European fascist powers are. And I think that's important, again, just as a historian. It's not to excuse it. And so please don't misunderstand me. It's just to understand how atrocities happen, that atrocities can happen even if you don't have monsters running the government. Quite the opposite, right? If you take the leash off and allow the dogs of war to just run free, you're likely to have atrocities, even though all sorts of people are likely to think they're there doing good things.
So when you describe that, to what extent are you intentionally, and to what extent is it incidentally a reference to your day job?
It's actually quite incidentally a reference to my day job. You know, when I started certainly doing this project, I really knew nothing about Japan other than kind of what I had heard in school, which was not all that much. And so I think when I approached this project, I assumed it would have a much more sort of clear through line of, you know, here are people who are engaging in show trials and war atrocities. Everything they would have done would have been clearly done in this kind of bad faith way. And therefore, you know, American justice, you know, triumphing by prosecuting them for doing these things would be extremely clear cut. It would be a very simple story to tell. And it was ultimately really the research process that I sort of saw these just trends inside of Japan's sort of governmental system of this period, some of which are familiar, right? And I don't think it's a mistake to draw the echoing comparisons or the rhyming comparisons with history where they exist. The idea that Japan's politics were deeply divided and that much of the worst that Japan did was done despite, not because of, the best intentions of very good people who were in the government and who had power. And, you know, so certainly that is something that I think we can relate to. We're a complicated society with very divided politics, and a lot of horrible things happen despite, not because of, the best intentions and the goals and aims of very well-meaning people in the government. So that, you know, that's a big part of it. I think, you know, I mean, but there are other comparisons that I just don't think are worth, you know, that don't hold. So one of the things that actually created this difficulty in making Japan, you know, making the Japanese military accountable to its civilian leadership is that it wasn't accountable. As a constitutional matter, the Japanese army and navy were essentially different branches of government, and their budgets were controlled in sort of the checks and balances way by the Japanese parliament, and policy, generally speaking, could be set by the cabinet. But when it actually came to the operation of the Japanese army, wherever it was operating, that was entirely to the discretion of the chief of staff of the army, who solely reported to the emperor, which means he reported to himself, because the emperor even then was, you know, as much a figurehead as anything else. And so a completely unaccountable military is something that, you know, that's not what we have. That's not the cause of any problems that we have in the United States. I think the racism is quite true as well. Now, Japan certainly wasn't unique in the 1930s and 40s about having, you know, deeply racist and chauvinistic foreign policy. Certainly the United Kingdom's conduct in places like India at the very same time were not models of liberalism and human grace. But, you know, U.S. foreign policy is just not. We're just not as racist a society. I know some people are going to say, yes, we are. But the United States is simply just not as racist a society today, or even throughout the war on terrorism, as Japan was in the 1930s and 40s. There's no even comparison.
Yeah, it's a kind of different order of magnitude.
It's a different order of magnitude, absolutely. And so, you know, so those comparisons don't hold. And a lot of the things you're talking about are consequences of those factors as well. But I do think it's just a mistake to attribute. I think it's a mistake. And I think it leads us to make the same mistakes that past, you know, good, well-intentioned people made in history. If we don't reckon with the idea that if you create climates of fear, if you create weak accountability mechanisms, if you maintain this sense that we wouldn't do that when you are doing it, that it's going to blind you and make you less capable of standing up for your own values when you need to, when it's hard. And I think that is a lesson that I think we can draw from this period.
All right, so let's move the story forward. The Kempeitai extracts confessions from the 8 survivors. They have military show trials for them. They execute 3, and the remaining 5 are imprisoned until the end of the war. So what happens to them?
Yeah, so they're held in solitary confinement until the rest of the war. You know, fairly meager food, very meager health care. One of the dual liberators actually ends up dying of what's called wet beriberi. It's essentially starvation in the winter of 1943. A second of the original 5 almost dies. He's about to die essentially in August of 1945. And then quite miraculously, the Office of Strategic Services, what ultimately became the CIA, but at the time was the sort of the U.S. commando unit, conducts a series of operations all around China to liberate American prisoners of war. And this is literally like days after the armistice. And so one of these teams, these commando teams, gets dropped out at a Japanese prison outside of Beijing called Fengtai. They land in the late afternoon, immediately take fire from the prison camp. But then a Japanese lieutenant comes out, rounds them up, takes them into the camp and says, "No one knows the war's over yet. And had you essentially come at dark, you would have been killed. No one would have been here to save you." But nevertheless, this commando team led by a major named Ray Nichols negotiates the release of about 500 prisoners of war who get put up in this plush hotel in downtown Beijing where they have this enormous victory party. And as that's going on, a rumor starts circulating that the dual liberators, the lost dual liberators, were in Fengtai. But no one in this plush hotel is a dual liberator. And so Nichols goes back to Fengtai, has a pretty blunt conversation with the warden of the prison and demands that they be brought out. And within about an hour, three of just sort of profoundly emaciated American airmen in these overfitting uniforms who've just freshly had their heads and faces shaved are brought out to the gates of Fengtai. And Major Nichols says to one of them, "You know, who are you?" And the guy introduces himself and says, "I'm Chase Nielsen. I was a Doolittle Raider." And Nichols sort of smiles and says, "Watch out for this guy. He's off his rocker." Because no one can believe it. Everyone at this point in the war assumes they're all dead. In fact, there's another movie made in addition to 30 Seconds Over Tokyo. There's another movie made in 1944 called The Purple Heart, which is essentially imagined version of what ultimately happens to the captured Doolittle Raiders, that they're put before this Japanese show trial and ultimately all executed. So no one in 1945 thought any of these men had survived. And so the fact that they had survived was just utterly miraculous. And it really just brought the Doolittle Raid, which had been this, you know, really just celebrated heroic moment, crucial moment in the war, back to the public imagination. And so the army makes almost immediately a priority out of finding the Japanese responsible for torturing and murdering the Doolittle Raiders and sets about doing exactly that.
Which brings us to trial number 2. How did trial number 2 come about, and who was tried for the? I mean, this decision, as you described it, kind of goes all the way to the cabinet level, right? To have this trial in this fashion and to create this kind of veneer of legality. So who do you end up holding responsible? Do you end up trying the Kempeitai people? I suppose that's the low-hanging fruit. But there's also a policy-level decision to do it this way, presumably knowing and intending that you're going to use a trial not to acquit, but to convict on the basis of confessions extracted by torture. So how high up does the accountability end up going, and what are the means that the U.S. Army deployed to accomplish that?
Yeah, this is what I mean when I say, you know, I set out initially to write like a pretty dry legal history of this. And as I started unpacking, particularly this part of the story, it just became so interesting and crazy that it was something, you know, I just thought more people would want to read about than sort of the handful of people who'd read a legal history about this. So this file, right, you have these early testimonies from the released Doolittle Raiders describing what happened to them. And the file falls on the desk of a young, he's 40 years old. So to me, he's young, army captain, and who's basically given the instructions, find out who's responsible. And he quickly finds out everyone's responsible, right? You can go all the way down to the Kempeitai who engaged in torture, all the way up to the emperor who commutes the sentence. And so he's stuck with this real problem of how do you really ascribe responsibility and accountability? When the executions of the Doolittle Raiders was publicly announced in 1943, Roosevelt, in what ended up presaging, you know, a real policy of using trials to go after war criminals, Axis war criminals, tempers the outrage in the United States, where there's this sort of just general call to just execute every Chinese prisoner the United States takes into custody. And he says, no, those responsible will be held personally and individually accountable. And so this mandate from Roosevelt that, you know, I mean, ultimately leads to a much larger policy dealing with war crimes, that this young or at least poorly equipped lawyer has to try and figure it out. And he runs himself ragged. He goes all over Asia looking for people, trying to figure out who's responsible. He finds the general in charge of the executions in Shanghai. He finds the warden who led the execution party. But ultimately, he hits upon prosecuting the lawyers and the judges who presided and prosecuted this war crimes, this show trial in 1942. And he does it on the idea that if you conduct a show trial, if you execute and subject people to things like solitary confinement on the basis of an unfair trial, what you've really done is engaged in the paperwork for murder. Just because your murder weapon is a legal judgment doesn't somehow immunize you from personal responsibility for what happens to these people after the fact. And so he ultimately hits upon the idea of prosecuting the lawyers and the judges for conducting an unfair trial. And that ultimately forces him in the subsequent trial, which also takes place in Shanghai, to put a trial on trial. And so you have this, you know, fairly fiercely fought debate over what is justice, right? It's a very heady thing to ask. It's the kind of thing you would ask in first year law courses or in, you know, Plato's Republic. But, you know, here you have these army lawyers in 1946 in a courtroom that was, you know, slapped together inside of Shanghai in order to prosecute the alleged murderers of the Doolittle Raiders, ultimately debating what is fairness, what is justice. And it just made for such a compelling story that that's ultimately why I wrote it the way I did.
And how fair was the trial of the trial? I mean, when the American forces tried the Japanese forces for doing the paperwork of murder, did they do better themselves than the paperwork of murder, or were these trials themselves show trials in some sense?
So I think they ended up being a lot more fair than the army hoped and intended. This is the time of the Yamashita trial, which by any, you know, reasoned historical review, even at the time, people understood to be, you know, barely a show trial to hold Yamashita responsible for the atrocities in the Philippines. You know, there's some vehement dissents from the Supreme Court in the decision in Re Yamashita, ultimately upholding it. And when the trial starts out, they actually don't even really give the Japanese a lawyer. There's only one lawyer who's willing to take the case because it will get him home faster, but he's a young captain himself. And so it's not seen as seemly to be accusing the Japanese of denying a fair trial and then giving them essentially the most junior person in the judge advocate corps to represent them. And so what they ultimately do, though, is tap a lieutenant colonel who was a pilot in the war, a decorated pilot, had won the Silver Star flying missions in China, who was eager to stay in Shanghai, not so he could serve as a lawyer, but because he had fallen in love with the concierge at the Bachelor's Officers' Quarter, this hotel called the Broadway Mansions in downtown Shanghai, where they were holding all the Army Air Force officers at the time. And he wanted to stay in Shanghai because he had basically fallen in love with a girl. And so they found him, and he looked the part. He had actually even gone to a little bit of night school before becoming a pilot, a little night school at Fordham Law School in New York. And he gets this case. Everyone assumes he's there to be the well-dressed potted plant to, you know, stand there and make it look good for the cameras, to make it look like we're being more fair than the Japanese were to us. I think certainly at the beginning, he sets out with that in mind. I think he thinks it's an impossible task. These men, who are charged are as much headed to the gallows as Yamashita was. Yamashita is actually executed the day before the arraignment in the Doolittle Raiders case. But he kind of just can't let himself do it, which is the most, to me, one of the more amazing parts of this book. Is he just commits to giving them a fair trial. He ultimately goes to Japan to investigate the case, to understand what happened on the day of the Doolittle raid. And he comes back and, you know, really just puts the prosecution to its evidence. He makes extremely controversial arguments that effectively end his military career as a pilot. But through his just doggedness and his sort of unwillingness to let this trial be a show trial, he ultimately makes it a fair trial. You know, one of the certainly heartening lessons that hopefully the book leaves readers with is that, you know, the essence of a fair trial is people. It's people who are really willing to be able to do their jobs under incredible pressure, political pressure, historical pressure, media pressure, and to basically commit, whether or not they're the prosecutor seeking justice for torture and murder and injustice, or the defense lawyer who's seeking initially just to stay in Shanghai for a love interest, but ultimately decides that he has to commit to, you know, representing these men because that's his job. That's his obligation to the rule of law. I hope it's actually a kind of a refreshing story because it's a story about good people trying to do the right thing and having a fight over what is the right thing. And it's a really remarkable story as a consequence.
So what's the outcome without getting into too much spoiler territory of the Japanese who are tried in the second Doolittle raid trial? How many are convicted and of what?
So I'll edge away from spoilers because the ending is kind of fascinating all by itself. But I'll say this, that none of them are executed. The expectation from the very beginning is that all of them will be as quickly and summarily executed as someone like Yamashita was. And none of them are given the death penalty. In fact, they're given very light sentences under the circumstances. And this itself provokes a public outcry again in the United States. And there are actually calls to have the trial redone because the lawyers, essentially the prosecutors are accused of screwing up the case. And so that the trial should be redone so we can get the death penalty against these Japanese who murdered the Doolittle Raiders. And so that itself becomes the sort of the closing controversy of the book is, are they going to actually, are we going to give up the fair trial of the Japanese in order to give in to our impulses for revenge? And so I'll leave that as a cliffhanger for people who are interested in actually getting to the end of the book.
I have one more question, which is, were any of the people tried among the Japanese defense lawyers in the original trial? And if so, to what extent does that make you reflect on your own role in contemporary military commissions that you have repeatedly denounced as unfair show trials?
So none of the there were no defense lawyers put on trial, no Japanese defense lawyers put on trial. Because the Japanese didn't afford defense lawyers. That was not actually a typical part of the military justice system in Japan at the time. It's an inquisitorial system. So the closest thing to a defense lawyer being prosecuted are the judges themselves, who are expected, as judges in many inquisitorial systems are, to essentially represent the interests of the accused in the clinical pursuit of the truth. And, you know, so did it reflect on, you know, my roles and my responsibilities, you know, in doing, I think it would have to. I don't know that I could tell you specifically what all those individual, you know, choices and influences might be. But I do think it certainly made me, I think I draw more actually from the trial in 1946 than I do from the trial in 1942, because there was this impulse, as you suggest, to, you know, basically make this trial fair enough that we are, you know, that it will pass the smell test for a public who's eager to see these four Japanese men executed. And the unwillingness of the American lawyer, even though he was, you know, horribly unqualified to be doing anything that he was doing, but the unwillingness to go along with that, to actually say, look, these may be, you know, horrible people. These people may have done horrible things. They may deserve the death penalty, but I'm going to fill my role, because that's the only way that, you know, we can test whether or not their execution is the just outcome. Because if I don't do my job, we'll always have this kind of stink if they're executed the way Yamashita has, right? One of the fascinating pieces of research that to come out of it for me is the Yamashita himself. Yamashita is actually a bit of a character in this book. And I think certainly, you know, people have written a lot of very sympathetic books about General Yamashita. The Supreme Court wrote very sympathetic opinions about him. Even General Douglas MacArthur, when signing his execution warrant, says very nice, sympathetic things about General Yamashita. But in the course of researching this book, you know, it kind of revealed Yamashita was probably one of the worst fascists in the entire Japanese army. He was personally responsible for fomenting a coup in 1936 that ultimately sends Japan down this chaotic militarist road that ultimately in turn leads it to initiate this war in China. The numbers of atrocities that Yamashita commits in the Malaya campaign are, you know, breathtaking. The mass rounding up and execution of just Chinese men and boys in Singapore after he takes over from the British in 1942. And yet somehow he has this kind of gauzy pastel colored reputation, because we know that we did not give him a fair trial for, you know, what he allegedly did in the Philippines. And so we have had this perverse sort of historical fact. We've created this perverse historical fact that Yamashita, of all people, is this, you know, icon of American injustice and, you know, the need for the rule of law in war, when history should point to Yamashita as one of the great war criminals of World War II, one of the great villains of the Pacific War. And so that was a really interesting just discovery in the course of my own research. But it's also one that I think does apply to our current policies in places like Guantanamo, where you have people charged with genuinely horrendous criminal acts, mass violence, you know, the murder of 3,000 Americans on a Tuesday for no real explicable reason. And somehow they've become, you know, like Nelson Mandela figures because of our own, you know, embrace of injustice, our own embrace of illiberalism and torture in dealing with them. And so I guess of the lessons, right, you know, in all the lessons I could sort of take from this book, the Yamashita lesson was the one that I probably found the most jarring as I was writing it.
The book is Last Mission to Tokyo, The Extraordinary Story of the Doolittle Raiders and Their Final Fight for Justice. The author is Michelle Paradis. Michelle, great talking with you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Our audio engineer this episode is Zachary Frank of the Goat Rodeo Endeavor. You need to do your part to promote the Lawfare podcast. Tweet the Lawfare podcast, share us on Facebook, rate and review us wherever you found us, pin us on Pinterest, and upvote us on Reddit. You can get Lawfare merch at thelawfarestore.com. The Lawfare podcast is produced and edited by Jen Patya Howell. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. And as always, thanks for listening.